So our next speaker today is going to be Daniel Starr from Boston, and he's going to talk to us about reasoning with reasons.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to stand up. I just find it easier to think when I'm standing up. There are various truisms. When we think about normative reasons, there are various things that we might take to be truisms that we might want to talk about. We might often raise these truisms first in order to be sure that we're all talking about the same subject matter, right? To make sure that we're all talking about normative reasons, because you want to avoid engaging in some dispute where it's really a terminological dispute. So you want to make sure that, even amongst different accounts of reasons, you're talking about the same thing. So one thing that you might take to be a truism about reasons is that we use them when we reason. That reasons are suitable for use in practical and theoretical reasoning, something along those lines. Now, Jonathan Way and other people, Kieran Sedia, and in work with Connor McHugh, Jonathan Way has been developing this view that reasons are premises of good reasoning. But that's what reasons are. He calls them a constitutive account of reasons. And I'm going to argue not that this is wrong, but that it's compatible with the deeper, with it being a deeper account of reasons, and that the deeper account of reasons that we should accept is the reasons as evidence account that I've defended quite a bit in the past. So it's an account of reasons, I'll call it reasons as premises of good reasoning, that starts from what I take to be a truism about reasons, and just says, well, that this is where we need to look if we want to come up with a precise analysis of what reasons are. I'll focus on Jonathan's version of the account. And I'm not going to be able to really do... I wish I could do more justice to it, but I think I'd need to speak for longer to really do justice to it. There are a lot of subtleties and features of the account that I'm just not going to be discussing, and perhaps some of them really matter, and perhaps Jonathan will be able to say that some of my criticisms aren't any good because some of these things that he's already said were overlooked. I'll focus on... I won't mention why I think it's preferable to Sedia's account, but I do think it's better than Sedia's account. I can say more about that if anyone wants to ask me. But it's spelt out there on the handout as R1. That's just a quotation from Way. For the fact that P to be a reason for S to phi is for there to be a good pattern of reasoning from the correct belief that P, perhaps together with other correct attitudes, which S has to phi. I inserted correct there before belief, but that just follows from, I think that's exactly, because he thinks the sound correct is true belief, for belief, and because he uses other in the sentence, other correct attitudes, I took it that he meant, that's not adding anything substantive. Okay, so according to reasons as evidence, on the other hand, a fact is a reason for an agent to phi if and only if that fact is evidence that the agent ought to phi. And that's the formula presented under reasons as evidence. Now, notice straight away that, one interesting feature of both of these accounts is that they both, they share the fact that there are two properties that they both have, which is they're unified and they're informative. They're meant to be accounts of reasons that extend to across all types of normative reasons, or at least we both sort of focus on reasons for action and reasons for beliefs. And in fact, Jonathan also says more about intentions than I did, but reasons for intentions. But they're meant to be very general accounts of normative reasons. That makes them unified across the different types of reasons. And they're informative because they're, you know, there's an actual analysis provided. Some accounts of reasons may be unified but not informative. So someone like Parfit or Scanlon might say, oh yeah, I've got unity. I think a reason just is, you know, a fact is a reason just that counts for an act or a belief. But both those people say that by talking about a reason counting for some action or belief, they're not providing an analysis. That's just repeating the word. You know, that's just synonymous for reason. So they don't have accounts that are unified and informative. And it's that, and both of these accounts are unified and informative. Okay. Now, maybe I should use an example, just for people who maybe are not on top of either of these accounts of reasons I should use an example. So, it's an example that both Jonathan and I use in various places, and we owe it to Ross, and it shows up the poverty of our imagination. But basically, you promise to meet a friend, and you come across somebody who's in urgent need of medical help, and you can't meet your friend. You have to, and you can't even contact your friend to tell them that you are able to meet them if you help this person. But intuitively, there's a much stronger reason to help the person. In fact, that's what you ought to do rather than fulfill the promise to your friend. Okay. So in that case, we'll take it that there's no issue of ignorance involved, and you just sort of know going on here. And you can, on Jonathan's view, you can move from the premise that, from belief, the true belief that the person is in urgent need of medical assistance, to an action that is the action of helping them by taking them to a hospital. Now, what about somebody who's in that situation and moves from the premise that they've promised somebody that they're going to meet them, and instead acts on that belief. I think we all think they're acting wrongly. And it's actually, Jonathan raises it as a problem for his view that it's, going to want to say that that's a good piece of reasoning, perhaps, if one acts on that premise. And, I'll come back to this issue, but I'll deal with that objection to his account that he himself considers in a moment. But I just wanted to illustrate how things work on his account. He also has examples. So, for instance, if you believe a certain act is permissible and it's a true belief, then it seems like it's good reason to move from that to forming intention. The example that I was thinking of. So you might form the intention to do the act, and what makes an intention correct is that it's based on the true belief in this way. So I take it that the deepest parts of his paper and other papers on that he's written are not concerned with the exact correctness condition. So I don't think the correctness condition is truth. But that, you know, if I spent the next 30 minutes criticizing him for that, it would be totally missing the point, because he's really trying to give an account of reasons that in many respects could, you know, I think there are good reasons why he thinks correctness has to do with truth, but we could have some other condition for correctness for each of these different states and still have the essence of his account of reasons, of course. Now, when we look at R1, it seems to me that it's possible that R1 and RAE are both true. And we can read reasons as evidence as giving a real definition of what a reason is. To say that reasons are premises of good reasoning may be to say something important about the role of reasons, but it's not clear that that's to tell us what reasons are, in essence. Now, here's a parallel case. In the philosophy of mind, you have this debate between realize a role functionalism and realize a functionalism. Defenders of these different views, right? So if we take pain, the functionalist might say that pain, you know, they might talk about all the features that we're intimately familiar with respect to pain. Maybe make that a little bit more rigorous, but talk about the instinct to, the behavioral instinct to avoid it, talk about the way we really don't like to be in pain and so on. They might come up with a description that is the basis of the functionalist account, that specifies the role that pain plays in our behavioral and mental life, right? And the role functionalist says that's what pain is. The realizer functionalist comes along and says, well, okay, what you've done now is you've specified, you've given us a definite description that allows us to pick up what pain is, but actually pain is C5 firing. Because that's the thing that fits this description. Now, one objection you can have to the one objection the role functionalist can have to the realizer functionalist is, well, okay, human beings, pain is C5 is firing, but it seems plausible that for Martians, pain, or for silicon-based life forms, say. That's not what pain is, but they could still experience pain if they had something that fulfills this role. And then the realizer functionalist might say, yeah, but that doesn't destroy my view, because what I'll do is I'll just go disjunctive and I'll say pain is C5 is firing, or it's silicon doing this, whatever, you know. Now notice that the realizer functionalist can say that, but there is the view is a bit weaker now in one way, which is that that no longer looks like a natural kind of property. It looks like we maybe do something more interesting when we're just talking about the picking out something that's close to the cutting nature of its joints when we look at just the description rather than the this long disjunct. It's not just going to be the C5 is firing and the silicon stuff doing whatever it is. It's going to be all sorts of possibilities. So I'm in the same situation where I want to claim that my account tells us what the realizer of this role is, but I'm not going to have to worry about that view, that move where one has to go all disjunctivist, because it's not that I'm saying this is what reasons are for human beings and they might be different for Martians. I'm in a slightly stronger dialectical position, I think, because I can just say, no, this is the one thing. If I can make the arguments there stick, what I'm trying to do is just say, this is just one thing that realizes that role. Okay, so what it at least seems like a sensible question, what sort of thing best realizes the role of being a premise of good reasoning, if anything does, quite generally. That at least seems like a sensible question. It might turn out that the answer is nothing, but it seems like there's nothing wrong with asking the question, right? So off to a good start there, anyway. doesn't get me very far, but one can ask the question. So what I'll first do is I'll run through, what I'll next do is run through a set of other options. You know, I've argued for reasons as evidence elsewhere, often with a co-author, Stephen Cohen's, and I'm not going to just sort of try going through old material here, repeating arguments I've given elsewhere, but rather, my strategy in this next section is simply to say, well, if we're playing this game of looking around anyway for something that might play the role, maybe reasons evidence does well relative to other candidates. Now, this list is not exhaustive, and you may well want to ask me about some other candidate for playing that role. But here are some candidates that might play the role. When we do normative ethics, we're interested in fundamental right makers and wrong makers, I take it. I mean, I'm putting particularism to one side and just considering the program of coming up with sort of more fundamental principles of ethics than are apparent to us when we're just looking at folk morality, right? So we're just trying to, whether we're consequentialists or non-consequentialists, we want to try to articulate and defend principles of right action. And I think when we do this, Part of what we're doing is trying to locate what the fundamental explanations for X being right or wrong are. And I think not enough people have paid attention, but this is something that I talk about in my book, but not enough people, philosophers, have paid attention to the fact that very plausibly the correct theory is going to be somewhat surprising and distant from folk morality. And you don't want to tie reasons too closely, read the nature of reasons too closely to just the fundamental right makers and wrong makers. I recently went back to, I needed to add a citation in my book, and I went back to Reasons and Persons and the discussion of the non-identity problem there. And I was really excited to find that Parker puts it in terms of fundamental reasons. He's like, I don't know about these cases. Even after he comes up with his own positive view, he's like, I'm really still unsure as to what the fundamental reasons are in non-identity cases. Right? This is a good example because it's like really recently discovered that there's this non-identity problem, and it's like clearly really interesting problem. And you know, maybe somebody solved it already, but it's not like we're all sure that somebody solved the problem in the right way. So Parfit, anyway, in Reason the Person, thinks that what he's doing there is trying to uncover a fundamental reason. Okay, surprising fundamental reason. So I suggest we focus on conscientious agents. Let's think about conscientious agents who are trying to act appropriately or correctly or act as they ought to do. And we think about, but we don't assume that they know what the correct moral theory is. Right? That's just not something most of us possess or have warrant for reasoning from a correct normative ethical theory. That's not a position we're in. Most agents are in. So assuming we're focusing on an agent like that, then I think option one doesn't get anywhere, because what we're thinking is, you know, should they use in their reasoning evidence concerning what they ought to do? That's my option. Or facts about fundamental right makers and wrong makers, which seems wholly inappropriate for the agent who's ignorant or at least not well justified in believing these certain propositions about fundamental right makers to reason using them rather than evidence concerning what one ought to do. If those two things come apart, you've got all this evidence concerning what you ought to do, and rather than follow that, you're going to just follow something that you have much less justification for. That just seems, or that you're ignorant of. That doesn't seem like a good idea. One of the things that we could, I'll just continue. So the second option, if we look at Parfit and Scanlon and so on, there's this notion that perhaps there are these primitive metaphysical reason relations. The real and the primitive. So now I want to say, well, if they come apart from, again, we can remember throughout all these examples, I want to not focus on the person who's all-knowing, but just on the run-of-the-mill agent. If they come apart from reasons concerning what you ought to do, you know, with each of these options, there's a possibility that they don't come apart, and that's interesting to consider. But if they do come apart, then I call these reasons star, okay? I don't believe that there are any reasons star, because I don't think that there are these primitive metaphysical relations. But suppose I'm just being open-minded about that, as I should right now, be open-minded about that. So I'm saying, well, you know, reasons star are these things if they exist. And so there is some sort of primitive metaphysical relation out there that may or may, you know, that's sort of floating out there. And I've got evidence concerning what I ought to do, and it comes apart from some primitive reason relation. I don't see why I would think it's appropriate to respond to some brute metaphysical relation rather than the evidence concerning what I ought to do. I think evidence concerning what I ought to do clearly does the job better here, right? When they come apart. So that seems to me to suggest that But is that that's read rationally appropriate to respond to, not not some primitive relation? So desires. When we think about desires, we can distinguish between actual desires that we just happen to have and the desires of an idealized agent. So I think what I'm saying is actually compatible with something like Michael Smith's view that, you know, if you know that a more idealized version of yourself would desire, or we've got to be careful, it's got to be an appropriate kind of idealization, but that the agent would desire that you have certain desires, you might shift your desires and so on. If we're actually focusing on actual desires, I think it's clear that, well, it should be clear, I think, that kind of very simplistic humanism isn't the way to go, because we recognize that ourselves, pre-philosophically, that our desires get things screw up all the time, right? And so if you've got evidence that you ought to do, suppose you're angry, and part of you recognizes you're kind of irrationally angry, right? Like, it would be really weird to think just because you've got a strong desire to thump someone in the face, and you've got plenty of evidence that you ought not to do that, but it's somehow appropriate to respond to your desire just because it's your desire is strong. Something like that. To make that stick, I've got to assume that weaker, in that the case I'm now describing, the although I said you have plenty of evidence, that doesn't go along with strong desires. I'm assuming in the present case that's sort of not going along with strong desires, I guess. But it seems actual desires. Now, in my view, the fact that you actually desire something can still be evidence that you ought to do it. So I'm not denying that. I'm just denying that that in general it's it's reasonable, rational, or appropriate to focus on the desires themselves as the key thing that you should be responding to. So there will be some convergence with my view, but it doesn't seem like just the fact that something is a desire makes it appropriate to respond, or yours makes it appropriate to respond to it. If we idealize, then there may just be no incompatibility with my view. I don't think that so the desires that the idealization might have, if we're buying the human picture, could be exactly the desires that track the evidence. So no incompatibility there. Fourthly, you might say, well, what we always rationally should do is just respond to a value ranking. Right, so this is the sort of thing some consequentialists don't have to say this, but because of course they've got this distinction between criterion and decision procedure. But some consequentialist utilitarians talk a lot about actual deliberators having value rankings. And I think that's not the right way to go here, because remember from the beginning I wanted to say, look, as far as ordinary agents are concerned, they are not committed to consequentialism. They may have some consequentialist type commitments, some non-consequentialist type commitments. But I think it's very plausible to view them as not having any of the non-consequentialist type commitments, and seeing everything in terms of value rankings. Unless you mean something, as came up in the last talk, you might mean something quite formal there, in which case I don't think there's any compatibility. It's not really not an alternative to what I'm saying, so it's not like the ordinary agents respond to this formal model or something, right? So, but if you mean that they actually base all the decisions just on judgments concerning value, then that's the appropriate way to go. In general, I think that's a mistake. If we're trying to be neutral, as we should be, about normal of ethical theory at the moment, right? So, what about beliefs that just happen to get the right results? Again, an idea familiar to us from the consequentialist tradition, independently of truth or justification. So, not even the speaker in the last paper wanted to say something as strong as this, obviously, that we just, explicitly rejected the idea that that even if you think practical considerations are relevant to beliefs, that you should, that's how you decide what to do, is just by considering the practical relevance of an option. What I should say is, you know, we're assuming that the actions flow from beliefs, to a large extent, of judgments, and when we are doing this, we could just take the frame of mind of, well, we don't care about epistemic justification or truth. We just, what's rationally appropriate to do is to just respond to whatever belief happens to produce a good outcome, or something like that. That just conflicts straightforwardly with a lot of judgments we have about the nature of reasoning and rationality. And I don't think anybody here actually thinks that, right? So I'll move on. We started at 11:30, is that right?
More like a quarter past.
Sorry, I'm getting confused. Okay. So Wei points out in the paper I'm mainly referring to, he points out that this account of reasoning made precise in formula R1 seems to have a problem, which is that many reasons are outweighed. He uses this term outweighed, which is interesting. And when they are outweighed, it will not be good reasoning to reason from relevant premise, the one that's the putative reason that's outweighed, to an action that the premise fails. All such cases appear to be counterexamples to R1, because it's just not good reasoning to reason from the fact that you promise to meet a friend, to meeting the friend, in the case where there's an alternative, which is to save someone's life. And you're aware of that. So he has a very interesting solution to this. He says, well, look, what we need to do is focus on the way in which patterns of reasoning can be defeasible. This is this is interesting. So it's good reasoning to reason from your belief that you promise to meet your friend to doing so when there's no countervailing consideration. But it's not good reasoning to reason from your belief that you promise to meet your friend to doing so when you also believe that you will thereby leave someone to die. And in the second case, it's instead good reason to reason from your belief that somebody nearby is going to die without your help, to a conclusion that is an act of saving them. So what is good reasoning when you just will always depend on what the particular attitudes are, the particular beliefs. Now, I've listed four problems here. I'm not sure. It's quite possible that after today, if I give this talk again or turn it into a fuller paper, that the section will look very different. Because I'm sure Jonathan has things to say about these four problems. One of them in particular I'm really unsure about, but it's a problem at all. But here's a first thought in response to just, this is the most natural, probably the one that flows most easily from the purported solution. It seems that there are weak reasons for action that even when they are not outweighed, it is not appropriate to act on. Even more clearly, maybe that's not true, but even more clearly there are weak reasons for belief that even when they are not outweighed, it is not appropriate to form beliefs in place. So even if you've got if all you've got is very weak evidence about a proposition, then it's not appropriate to form a belief in that proposition. So it seems that on Wei's account, he can of course say, yes sir, that all such instances are simply not good forms of reasoning. But we need more, because this solution does not in itself provide resources to distinguish between weakness of this kind and weakness of the kind he has in mind. So I'm not claiming that there isn't some solution to this problem that's consistent with his account. I'm just saying it's not there in the solution to the weighing reasons objection. And that reveals something about weighing and the weight of reasons, something important that we have to sort of still take account of. Problem two is the one I'm least sure of. I don't know. And it's maybe unfair. I worry that now we just think for every combination of beliefs and so on, there's like fact of the matter about whether it's a good form of reasoning or a bad form of reasoning. So we've gone really fine-grained. We've just got like all these different good forms of reasoning, bad forms of reasoning. And I think it may have been unfair for me to put this on the handout as is it just a brute fact that there are a huge number of good forms of reasoning? It's a question. But it's unfair because Jonathan does say more about good forms of reasoning. So the correctness preserving is one thing he says. And the second is that when we think about agents, he says that they have to be, for a good form of reasoning to be a good form of reasoning for an agent, we have to think of them as being sensitive to it as a good form of reasoning. Now, he doesn't say a lot about that, at least in the material I read, what the sensitivity amounts to, but it's a recipe. We can see that there may be something important there that can be added in terms of sensitivity to certain forms that makes this... well, I still worry that... Yeah, I worry because there's a... So we're saying that good forms of reasoning are correctness preserving. Fair enough. But, and so in a way that sort of unifies all these different forms of reasoning that are out there. But of course there are many ways in which good forms, so fallacies can be correctness preserving, right? Fallacious reasoning can be corrective preserving. Correctness preserving. Just because for correctness preserving all we're thinking about here is you start with correct states and you get correct states at the end. So all sorts of stuff that we wouldn't even normally call reasoning can be correctness preserving, but even if we focus on fallacious reasoning, that can often be correct. Now, so it's going to be really... The devil's in the details when it comes to what sensitivity amounts to here. And I worry that if you say the good forms of reasoning sort of proliferate, and you've got all these good forms of reasoning, and then you talk about sensitivity... Do you mean that you have to be sensitive in the ethical domain... you have to be sensitive to all these particular defeasible good forms of reasoning? Is there some deeper good form of reasoning that you're sensitive to? You see what I mean? So perhaps this objection isn't terrible, but it is quite complex once we start thinking about what the objection really amounts to. I'm not sure I've quite put my finger on it. I should probably move on. But I think a lot will depend on what Jonathan has to say about sensitivity there. Great. But here's another interesting issue. I take it when we talk about... So remember that Jonathan wants his account to be unifying across reasons for action and reasons for belief. And when we think about reasons for belief, I don't think we're going to say that they're substantive in this... I've got to be careful how I put this. Notice that his solution to the weighing reasons problem is to say, in this one case, this is a good form of reasoning, and in this other case, it wouldn't be a good form of reasoning because there are other beliefs involved. Suppose somebody just agreed, a Kantian who takes promise-keeping to be really absolute, just gets in a moral disagreement argument with us about this case. And it doesn't matter because it could be some other case where it is more contentious what we ought to do. But somebody gets in a big argument with us about this case. Are we really going to say, you're just engaging in bad reasoning? I'm not saying... We could say you're engaging in bad reasoning when we look at their actual arguments for the Kantian view or whichever view we're considering. But I'm just saying, insofar as you're reasoning from the fact that it's a promise to the conclusion you ought to fulfill your promise, you're engaging in bad reasoning. I think we all agree... Suppose that view's wrong, we all agree it's wrong, and we all, but it seems like the wrong way to capture the wrongness is to say it's bad reasoning. And my point here is it's not the way we do it in the belief case. We want a more general solution in the belief case. We don't make it hang on the substantive ethical facts in the same way, would be my worry, that it's not unified across action. One form this worry takes is that this isn't a unified solution across action and belief. And I just think it's a worry that what turns out to be good reasoning just depends on ethically substantive matters, whereas on a lot of other accounts it won't. After all, in giving his account of good reasoning and focusing on correctness, I took it that it was meant to be an account of reasoning that's backing away a bit from substantive, that's meant to be very general in scope and backing away a bit from having to be pinned down by substantive commitments. But maybe I'm misunderstanding what Jonathan is trying to do. So finally, we take reasons to have weights or strength, and it seems like this, well, people disagree with this, so, but from my point of view, it seems like the phenomenology here is that reasons pull us with different strengths in different directions, and we're these days anyway, we talk about reasons this way. And one to make this a more standard, you can consider a series of examples where one can either help one person or help another person. One can't help both people. And all we vary across the series, so suppose we keep the amount of pain that one person is experiencing constant, and then we just vary the amount of pain or pleasure that the other person is experiencing across the series of examples by very small increments, say. And it seems like our natural response to that is to say, oh, the reasons are just increasing in strength across this range of examples, and that just seems a very natural thing for most of us to say. The reason on one side is increasing in strength. And at some point, it tips over, and so, you know, it's appropriate to actually help A rather than B. Right? But I take it that Jonathan's instead going to say, up until that point, there's nothing to say about the reason varying in strength. It's just that it's a bad form of reasoning to help A rather than B. And after that, it's a good form of reasoning to help A rather than B. To come to the conclusion that is the action of helping A rather than B. And so I worry that that doesn't capture everything we want to say about the weight of reasons. On the last page, I say a little bit about what I actually think which will do the job here. And so I think that knowledge is the criterion of correctness for belief and for action. And I think we can get an account of the weight of reasons using the reasons as evidence account and also talking about probability, epistemic probability. So in my book I suggest that the reasons evidence account fits together very nicely with Williamson's account of evidence, knowledge-based account of evidence, that the evidence for the truth of a proposition is the content of your knowledge. But I don't spend much time on that. I don't have any new arguments or new responses to critics regarding, you know, I know it's very contentious regarding that account of evidence. Rather, what I do is I look at the knowledge norm, and it's pointed out in the literature by Ichikawa, for instance, that the knowledge norm, as it's often stated, just doesn't give us... So, as stated there, it's rationally appropriate or correct for A to treat P as a reason for action just in case A knows P. And in his book, that's roughly what Williamson says. And then Hawthorne and Stanley do say more because they focus on preferences. So I shouldn't misrepresent what they do either. But they don't carefully distinguish in their paper, as they acknowledge in a footnote to Slimberger, who pointed this out, that originally, they don't sort of clearly distinguish between the question of when it's appropriate to respond to a reason, and when it's appropriate to take some consideration as a reason, and when it's appropriate to act. Okay. The knowledge norm can be taken to, at least it's a good project now to try to fill out the knowledge norm some more, because it's not enough just to say, for those of you who aren't familiar with this, I should say, well, why is it not just enough to say it, to state this knowledge norm for someone who wants to turn this kind of view? Well, there are lots of counterexamples, putative counterexamples to the knowledge norm of the following kind. Suppose a doctor knows what operation the patient requires, but still believes he ought to check, it's appropriate to check the chart where he operates It's not just that we think that's kind of permissible. We might actually think that's exactly what doctors should do. It's great that that's what they're doing, right? So it seems like what's appropriate to do is not act on this knowledge that... it's not appropriate for them to just act on the knowledge that this is what the patient... Even in those cases where they do know that the patient needs a certain operation, it's actually appropriate for them to check the chart. Now, as Ichikawa points out, that's not actually... Those sorts of counterexamples are not counterexamples that people who defend the knowledge norm must have a problem with. But they bring out that we need to say more about which bits of knowledge it's appropriate to act on. It's not enough just to say knowledge, right? It's not appropriate to act on, you know, I know what my name is, but it's not appropriate to act on that by storming out of the room. It's just like, this says nothing about which bits of knowledge it's appropriate to act on. Okay, so I'm hoping that my account fills this out in the right way. And version 1 is probably the one I want to stick by. I just put in version 2 because these are Connor and Jonathan are big fans of permissibility. And I'm trying to think about how one would do it with permissibility if that's the way you want to go. But and maybe version 2 is not quite right because it's still... Yeah, anyway. But what I want to... I'll just quickly describe version 1. What I'm saying there is simply... And I'll probably stick to my guns and want to just defend version 1. But... it's appropriate to treat a fact merely as the reason for action, outweighed or not, in case it is known and it is evidence that one possesses that one wants to do a particular act. Second, it's rationally appropriate to act on a reason to defy just in case either one knows one ought to defy. Or, so that's one bit of knowledge it is okay to act on, right, straight away without having to consider other things. If you know that you ought to fire, then it's appropriate to fire. Because it is the case that you ought to fire, and you've got the, you know, great justification, so, you know, why not just do it? or, in those cases where you don't know what, well, I shouldn't put it by that. Or, the evidence that one possesses concerning what one ought to do makes it most probable that one ought to fire relative to one's other options, or no less probable that one ought to fire and do some other act. Now, with belief, this is going to be a bit more complicated because with belief, well, it will be complicated for many reasons, but one is that you always have the option of not believing. So I'm not going to want exact parallel in the case of belief. Because with acting, as long as you're conscious and as long as you can do anything intentionally, you don't have the option of suspension, whereas with belief, you have the option of suspending belief. Or just not believing if you haven't even believed. In the first kind of case, the evidence one possesses concerning what one ought to do will warrant drawing the conclusion one ought to fire, while cases of the second type will be those where one is not warranting concluding one ought to fire, but where action is nonetheless required, and one must thus do one's best to follow the goal of acting as one ought to. Okay, I'll end there. Thank you.